Accession number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Reel 25. Now, so what happened? So because you left the RAF, was it because of this incident?
Well,
what happened?
It was quite complicated, really. The first thing that apparently happens, I was put under, I think, effectively close arrest. It was close arrest to start with, up in the mess. And I did feel quite sleepy then, and it was, I think, to do with the drugs I'd been given. But a medic came across to check I was all right. He came across from, I forget, from the Nocton Hall, I think he came from, but he was actually a neurologist or something like that, a kind of shrink guy. And he pronounced me fit and well, apart from the fact that I'd got this very heavy cold. And what happened was the heavy cold did turn into pneumonia. And as a side element that is linked with pneumonia, and that's with or without the drugs, you can get in a slight state of what they call mild hypomania, where you've... You probably think faster, and a lot of people can get into trouble in that state. It's a euphoric state. Well, flying itself is, most people are pretty euphoric when they get down from flying fighter aircraft. Beyond that, when I went home, because I was kept in the mess, I think, 2 or 3 days, and it all got a bit political, because I mean, all I wanted to do was to go off and have a few days leave and go back to the squadron, but there was such a furore that when I did go back to my family at out at, because we were lodged out at Bertram Newton, the press were all round, and you know, I couldn't go out of the door really without it, because I didn't want to speak to the press at all, and there were photographers there and goodness knows what. And I think partly because of that, and partly because I was having trouble sleeping then, they decided that the most convenient thing was to shove me off to Nocton Hall and get me into an RAF place out of the way of the press. And
What's Nocton Hall?
Nocton Hall was a kind of sort of hospital area there. And the idea was I was just to go there and to stay out of the way as much as anything.
And you had pneumonia at this point.
Yeah. Well, it was gradually developing, yes. And it when I got to Nocton Hall, the slightly sad thing was...
is that Nocton spelled?
Nocton Hall. It's now closed down. But it was, I want to say, somewhere outside Norwich, but I'm wondering whether it is now. But up there somewhere. And when I was there... again, I probably slept for 2.5 or 3 hours, and then I had this very vivid flash, and I only had it once, this flashback, where I sort of woke up, and I was there sort of flying through the bridge again, I think it was, and I was fortunate, really, because that was the only flashback I ever did have on all that lot. I'm pretty certain that I woke up in an agitated state in wherever I was in this. I think I was in a shared room or something like that. And then I got a bit fed up. I'd been on a escape and evasion course, and one of the first things you do, because, well, what I hadn't mentioned was that at West Raynham, they'd taken a long statement from me. To start with, I just, when the police chap arrived, the Provo bloke, to take a statement, I literally just gave him my number, rank and name. And then, you know, he went away, and he was virtually on his knees, you know, to get things out and that. And obviously there was a lot of pressure there, and I felt slightly sorry for the bloke. And then I did I think I gave him 20 pages worth from memory, and that was another element. But at when I was at Nocton Hall, after this kind of flashback business, having been trained in escape and evasion, the first thing you, or one of the first things you learn is, as soon as you're caught, the easiest way to escape is to escape early rather than later. And this was running through my head, and it might sound a bit irrational, but I was getting a bit fed up being pushed around then by people told what I could and couldn't do, because as far as I was concerned, all I wanted to do was to go off quietly for 3 or 4 days leave, and that was the last thing that the Air Force hierarchy wanted, because they were worried about the press, I think. And rightly or wrongly, pretending to escape is one of the elements that helps you to escape. And I just whipped out and got on the roof of the flat roof of this sort of hospital ward area that I was. And then I realized what a terrible mistake I'd made, because within 10 or 15 minutes, it was absolute pandemonium. They were really worried that I'd escaped, and B, that they'd be in trouble. And I realised that I'd made a very silly move there. When I did get down, I was obviously in, and they realised what I'd done, to sort of wind them up a bit. But I more or less did that for my own morale. They really got quite anti on the whole thing. And that evening, I remember when I couldn't sleep properly, I can remember they actually attacked me with this needle to put me out. And that I found was a very, what's the right word? That really hit me in my psyche, it was almost as though it was a violation of my person, and they filled me full of this, whatever it was, drug that they gave me, because I came to in the ambulance, and they had taken me down to Rawton, RAF Hospital Rawton, where they had their chief shrink, a wing commander, Lawton, a super chap. And I can remember stumbling out of that ambulance, really drugged and just able to stand and walk, and feeling a bit bloody angry about everything. And of course, anger at incidents like that does not really help your well-being. And then the pneumonia took over, and they were helping me get over that. And then, really, to cut a long story short, this guy, Wing Commander Lawton, that had dealt with a lot of the Bomber Command problems in the war, and he was a splendid bloke. Completely the other way round to me. He was, because he used to say that to me, that he was really what they call a mildly depressive chap. He would sit there like a big bear with his cigar. And he was completely the other way around, whereas I was slightly euphoric, even normally. And he strongly wanted me to be court-martialed. And to cut a long story short, I wasn't court-martialed, which I wanted.
Why weren't you left the
Air Force.
Court-martialed?
Well, I think it's difficult for me to say, really. But
just quick, because you've been through most of the reasons as we've moved on through the internet. Well, could you summarise, in your view?
When I was down there, the only writer an officer that's got a permanent commission in the Royal Air Force has, and an inviolable right, is to see his air officer commanding in chief, because that's what I asked for. But because of the strange mix of, I think there was political involvement in it, because when I went up for my final medical, all that had been when my future was announced in Parliament by the deputy, and a rather splendid bloke who'd been in the Air Force during the war, and he was a friend of Duncan Smith, I'm trying to think of his name, an ex-intelligence officer, and he was Deputy Secretary of Air, and he actually announced in Parliament that I would be invalided out, and this was before I had my final medical, and obviously I was a bit shirty about what happened and how it had happened, particularly since this splendid bloke, Wing Commander Lawton, wanted me to be court-martialed because he thought it would be a good thing, not just for me, but for the Air Force as well. But that was not to be.
Now,
and
why did you want
I had
to
no
be
right to...
Why did you want to be
to see the AOC? Well, I think it was really that there was... it was to do with a whole variety of things, but really the... As I say, the national morale then was extremely low. And the other interesting aspect at that time was what was... at the time my future was decided was exactly at the same time as the Wilson coup plot, when you probably know the background with Mountbatten and the chap, the chief scientist, and the Cecil King and the Mirror chairman and the involvements there that they literally were trying to displace Wilson. The idea was that things had got so far and so bad that, and that was happening at exactly the same time as my future was decided. And of course, I was not exactly a happy bunny, really. But to cut a long story short, afterwards, I started with Ford.
No, hang on. How did they put you out of the RAF? What happened exactly?
Well, I was given a medical discharge. And
on what grounds?
Well, perhaps slightly correctly, on the fact of, I think they put it down, I think it was called hypomania, episode. But as far as I was concerned, there were still a lot of things I could have done in the Air Force. And if I'd had sort of maybe 3 years, but being separated also from one's squadron and all that lot was, and the way things happened, it was coincidental, I suppose. But that also was probably not the best outcome, and the links with the drugs and the pneumonia.
And so all this, how long did it take? I mean, when were you put out? It looks like October.
Oh, yes, you're right. And I was dined out from the squadron, I think, from memory, in October. That's quite right. And by which time, my fourth child, and that was the other element, we'd got four children under five then, well, under six, five and a half, I suppose, Alison was. And the strange thing was, they were saying that there was no sweat, that I was coping quite well with everything, and that there was no reason that I shouldn't go out because of the fact that all the family situation was right. But the other way around, Anne was blind, deaf and paralysed from the from meningitis that she had. But that was a ray of sunshine in a way, because the chief specialist up at Addenbrookes had said that since we had three older children, that we were to leave her in the care of, where they looked after people for ever and a day as cabbages. And fortunately, we came south, and somebody else, another doctor at Queen Mary's, started from scratch with her. And 6 weeks after 6 weeks' time, she gradually started smiling, her sight came back, and she's ended up just sort of mentally handicapped, but can see, and she can talk now, which is splendid, really, because she was blind, deaf, paralysed, etc. And if I hadn't left the Air Force, things might have well been different on that front, so that probably worked out for the best.
Now, very quickly, could you sketch out, before we finish, we just want to do a bit about your work with the War Widows campaign, I think.
But well, it's just
start. Can you just sketch out your career in industry? It's not really.
I moved.
Pitch,
yeah.
Just so people know what happened.
Yeah, I was with Ford to start with, and then I got very interested, obviously, in this case of side reactions or reactions to drugs, and I did rightly or wrongly experiment there when I was at Ford. Because I was convinced that it was the drugs that had caused the problem, and I think that was another element. You asked why I hadn't been court-martialed, and I think one of them, because they'd taken these drugs back from me, and I think that was another element, you know, on the publicity side that would have come out in a court-martial, the problem with these drugs, which did come out much later, within 15 or 20 years, and it probably took that length of time, and programmes on the BBC and that, the slow awareness that a lot of drugs, for some people, can cause the exact reverse effects, which it had done with me.
And just sketch out your career.
Yeah, well, just leaping forward, then we weren't that happy living up in Essex, and at Ford, I was experimenting a bit, rightly or wrongly, with this aspect of not sleeping and what have you. But I then moved down to Dennis and the export side at Dennis Motors here in Guildford, and then was with Plessy, and before that with Rediffusion on simulators, but almost all to do with export related work. And then I took my management consultancy exams in Spearhead Exporting, really, and also marketing research abroad, and I did a lot of work in Africa and the Middle East, initially with motor industry, heavy trucks, and then more in the defence industry, mainly Africa and Middle East and some in the Far East, and then started my own tiny little company. And it was then that I started to shift into the area where I had a very useful and amount of money coming in from the Siemens Group, where I was doing some consultancy for the Siemens Group, the German side of which had been heavily involved in the equipment that actually bombed Tangmere in the war. But because of the links with 1 and 43 Squadron, both squadrons were the pre-war Tangmere's own squadrons, and they'd been together some long time when one squadron came back from the Middle East, from Iraq, and joined 43 there. They'd been the two Tangmere squadrons, and Tangmere was the sector station it was really probably the most important station pre-war in terms of its morale and its position and what have you. But once the war started, of course,
not so much about the history of Tangmere.
Biggin Hill was more important, but really what I'm saying was Tangmere was a very important place. We, just by coincidence, we were the last fighters in and out of Tangmere, and partly with that link and the 1 and 43 squadron, I got involved with starting the museum again with this person that I got to know, Jimmy Beadle, who wrote the definitive history of 43 Fighting Cox Squadron, and that was in 1980. On the 40th anniversary of Battle of Britain, I had this money from Siemens, and I'd been on a one-day course, how to a seminar on how to start museums, and really that was the beginning of that. Beyond that, and after initial troubles, because they weren't getting the charitable trust set up fast enough, we slightly split because it was important. I felt that the whole future of the museum could be jeopardised if I dug my heels in, and the other two went ahead, and there were 3 or 4 years of development, but at the same time, development away from the charitable trust, which is eventually set up in 1986, but there were problems even beyond that. But thank goodness all that's clear now with the aircraft they've got down at Tangley Museum. But I'm just mentioning that because that diverted me slightly sideways to get very involved with the War Widows campaign.
Yeah, we are very interested. Tell us, we've got...
Well, very, very briefly, the 40th anniversary of the Battle of Britain Day obviously was on the 15th of September. It always is 15th of September, the date, which happened to be my parents' wedding anniversary, and it's nice and easy for me to remember. And it was a Saturday in 1980, and that's why we picked that role. And having been involved and knowing the people that were running the Red Arrows then, which was another element I didn't mention down at Chichester before I flew past, London, because I knew well what was denied in the press later, but the flypasts that were originally supposed to happen on the 1st of April were cancelled at a very high level, and it was denied later, but I knew full well, and before I'd flown over London, because we'd heard them on the RT, the Red Arrows, and I'd been in touch with the Red Arrows and knew that their flypasts had been cancelled. That's something I hadn't mentioned, because I knew the guys personally. They were people a little later behind me, and Ray Hanna and the other people in the team I knew and heard from them.
We're drifting away from
going ahead then, our guest of honour down there jointly was Lord Balfour, who I knew from 43 Squadron's committee, who was then by then our president, jointly we had Muriel Nicholson, who was the widow of the only fighter Victoria Cross holder, who was started at Tangmere but then won his Victoria Cross on 249 Squadron, having 72 Squadron. His first Spitfire Squadron was formed out of one squadron, but that was the link with Nicholson, and Muriel was our guest of honour for the event we had down to launch the museum on the 40th anniversary. Rather splendidly, she picked out, we had £1,940 as the prize, and it was actually by an incredible hundreds of thousands to one chance, a Battle of Britain baby won the prize, who was actually born during the Battle of Britain in the right place as well, down in southeast England. But through Muriel, I got to know Iris Strange, and Iris Strange was the fire in the furnace of both the first War Widows group and the second. And she didn't want to necessarily start another group up, but other War Widows wanted her because they knew the talent she had. And she struck me as being 20 minutes, less than that. I had 15 minutes on the telephone to Iris, who was a great friend of Muriel's, and that's how I got involved with the War Widows campaign.
Now, what is the War Widows campaign?
Well, it was really a national disgrace in many ways that in Germany, as I learned later, they had so many War Widows that politically they had to act and did act by 1946. And beyond there, they had all sorts of perks and privileges, quite correctly, perhaps. Whereas over here, it was the reverse. We had almost too few of them. And, of course, we hadn't been overrun. And so we'd gone to war rather than... And it was way when you're overrun, I think, as much as anything, you really know what war's all about. And through Iris Strange, I got quite involved in the 1980s with trying to support her in any way I could. And we had
So what were they asking for?
There's a War Widows garden down at the back of Tangmere Museum to this day that's been developed in a slightly different way, the memorial gardens there. So, but it really, they eventually did get, which was great, right at the end of 1989, the facility for £40 tax-free as being, as of right.
As a pension, yeah.
Because the really bad aspects were the volunteers who'd, because I can remember, I really learned to read as a 3 or 4 year old with the posters up that were there in the early war, as you'll remember, you know, your country needs you, and there was sort of Kitchener looking at you and with his pointing his finger. And really a lot of those blokes that had joined as volunteers, if they were killed, their wives literally had a pittance. It was a pound with, I think, 1 shilling or it was something very like that per child. And many of them didn't remarry in those days. And really, it was a national disgrace. And there were two groups of war widows. And Iris really was involved with the first and did an awful lot for the first. And then she was asked to start the second lot. The first group were very much more linked with the British Legion and the official aspects, and she was correctly militant. Her husband had been killed in the Far East and had survived the Burma Railway and then was killed by the Japanese just before the end of the war. And she was a very fine individual, I thought. And I was asked, I believe, Vera Lynn who got involved in 1989, as you might remember, with the campaign, with the Officers' Pension Society, put up £35,000 for the PR campaign. And that was the final burst of realisation. But politically, why they caved in the government after so long having said that, A, they couldn't do it, B, they wouldn't do it, and couldn't afford it and all that lot, and it'd be impossible. But a main reason that they did cave in then was the amount of publicity generated in that PR campaign at the tail end of 1989, realising that for 6 years there would be the 50 years on anniversary. Yes, 50 years on anniversaries for a full 6 years of all the battles and things like that. And politically, that was why they caved in. And the MP up at Macclesfield, I must say, Nicholas Winterton, was superb on that, because he was the only one clearly to see and support Iris Strange. And it was incredible the amount of effort she had, but her heart was really in the right place, because she looked after their welfare. She had a tremendous number of letters, and there's some marvellous work being done for a PhD on the history of the War Widows campaign, which is a sad indictment on the our political process, how successive governments of both colours had done very little for them.
Was it just pensions, or was it other rights you were looking for?
Oh, well, beyond that, I mean, I was less interested in beyond there, because they were more anomalies then of post-service marriages and things like that. But really, the breakthrough was that £40 as of right.
That was given, yeah. What year, 1989?
Well, I think it was sanctioned in 89, and I think it was about spring of 1990 that the money started flowing. But of course, every year they delayed, these people were dying, and many of them in tragic circumstances, many of them.
Now, what did you actually do for the campaign? Do you see what I mean? What was your role?
All I did was to try and support wherever I could.
In what way?
Iris's way. I went up two or three times to Whitehall and elsewhere, and then I realised too that occasionally I could get away, because I suppose I must have been arrested on that, and I got involved with the Guildford Four case too by complete coincidence, because I could see in advance the problems there'd be about the injustice there, where they'd got incorrect people, and that. And strangely, I could see that when I went up to see important people, literally to go in, I went up into the cabinet office and upstairs and saw various other people, and also at the DPP and less in the MOD. But I used to ring them up quite a lot about this. And eventually I can remember to the second and the minute, because I got it recorded somewhere, where I got the daughter, Mrs. Ludwig was her name, the daughter of the guy Gingell, who General Gingell was running the Officers' Pension Society. And it was through her daughter chatting up her mother about the requirement, eventually got him. And I can remember, because she was on public relations, and that was the way the money started, which eventually broke the back of the whole campaign and the government's decision to shift. And now I see in exactly the same way parallels with something I'm involved with at the moment, with these people that have lost their pensions, because those were government guaranteed pensions. These people that you know have been stripped of their pensions at the moment, 120,000 of them. But that's another story. But I'm hoping they will win through with this marvellous lady that they've got, Ros Altman.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.